Today's program was brought to you by Franco Lania's Minnesota Wild Rice Griddle Cakes. For more information, visit francolania.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. You can follow us on Instagram at feast.yr.ears. Today is episode 19 of Feast Your Ears. Joining me in the studio today is Samir Patel, who's deputy editor of Archaeology Magazine. Samir has written about archaeology and exploring our history for the last 10 years or so. Thanks, Samir, for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks for having me, Harry.
So I usually start out by asking people what they do. I usually know what my guests do, but I like to have it explained in their own words for the listeners.
Right. Well, I'm a magazine journalist and editor. I write, edit, commission, photograph, travel to report on stories about archaeology. And so I do feature stories in the main part of the magazine, and also am the editor of the front of the magazine, which has smaller pieces about news. And so I try to, we try with a relatively small staff to cover the whole world and a millennia worth of history through the kind of material culture that archaeologists dig up when they go out in the field.
Nice. I was fascinated with archaeology and more specifically with paleontology when I was much, much younger, when mm-hmm. I was, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. Dinosaurs sort of caught my attention. And I, of course, at the time thought that everything about being in that field was being out in the field, being out digging things up and discovering giant bones and sort of finding artifacts.
Yeah.
And I did an internship when I was 12 or 13 with a paleontologist at the Peabody at Yale.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
And discovered very quickly that most of the work, in fact, was sitting at a desk and writing grants in a windowless office.
Yeah.
Not actually the sort of excitement of being out in the wilderness finding things.
Well, one of the great things about my job, though, is I get to kind of parachute in on some of these digs and show up for, you know, a few days or a week and visit a couple in exotic locations sometimes and don't have to do a lot of the difficult, both physical and analytical work. So I don't have to be, you know, analyzing data necessarily afterward. And I certainly don't have to turn over shovels full of dirt and spend entire days on my knees.
That's really neat. Do you, so what, is there a time limit of history that Archaeology Magazine covers? I mean, is there a point where you sort of stop?
Well, I mean, archaeology as a discipline is specifically related to the material culture and remains of humans. So it's got to go back as far as humans do. That said, there is a little bit of a crossover into what we call paleoanthropology, which is study of ancient man. So, I don't know, a couple million years,
sure,
you know, to when we can start calling things that are evolving into people, you know.
Man.
At least human precursors. Yeah.
And then on the other end of that, I mean, you know, like rotary dial telephones, do those count as like something that would be covered in archaeology?
This is, you know, it's funny. There's probably a traditional kind of line that says that archaeology needs to be of a certain age. It's never something I've believed because I think that we're constantly creating material culture and archaeology is all around us. And so I'm always looking for these contemporary historical stories as well. So I've written about modern graffiti and looking at that in an archaeological context in terms of actually studying it as an artifact of humans. And I just recently did a piece on cigarette butts because there's a researcher at Connecticut College who, as a project for his students, had them go outside of bars in Connecticut and collect cigarette butts over a long period of time and establish this giant data set that the students could work with so that they could see how you establish the types of artifacts and what you can learn about the culture, for example, of a punk bar versus the culture of a sports bar by looking at their cigarettes.
Right.
And so it's an exercise, but they're actually coming up with some interesting data out of stuff like that. So I think that, I don't like to put a limit on when archaeology ends, but there's often, you know, we'll get readers who have a bit of a beef when I do those more contemporary stories. But I think in general, people probably find it pretty interesting, and it's a new way to look at, you know, our history and our culture, and
yeah.
realize that we're constantly creating archaeology.
Right. All the time. So Samir and I met a few years ago. Samir was working at the time on an article about butchers and prehistoric men, right?
Yeah, this would have been less about butchers and more about the tools.
Tools, right.
Actually, yeah.
Right. So the tools that prehistoric man would have used in relationship to cutting up animals mm-hmm. and approached myself and my partners at the Meat Hook to test stone tools on an animal that was theoretically similar to something that an early man might have been able to
sure,
kill.
Yeah.
And we used a whole lamb that we were able to source with the skin still on and had, you know, Tom Mylan, who was then one of the butchers at the Meat Hook, basically take apart this whole lamb
yeah.
using stone tools instead of metal knives.
Right. And this grew out of a story that was about the tools, but really, you know, I first encountered these stone tools when I was on a reporting trip in India. And one of the grad students who was there was a flint knapper. And that's what you call people who make these stone tools. And today there's lots of flint knappers, most of them recreational, so they're trying to make cool arrowheads and sort of fancy things. But there's a subset of archaeologists who are experimental archaeologists, and what they do is they try to recreate ancient technologies. And so I was kind of fascinated when he started showing me how you do this thing, you know. And
you essentially take two rocks and hit them together,
yeah,
right? I mean, that's
smack
sort
them
of
together,
it.
Right? But there's so many subtleties, right. you know. And so I decided at that time to try and do a story, which actually I haven't seen all the way through quite yet, but about learning how to flint knap and about what experimental archaeology with regard to stone tools teaches us. Because for this huge swath of human history, we're talking about going back 2 million years, for the vast majority of that time between then and now, the primary artifact, and in a lot of cases the only artifact we have that survives, is stone. And so these tools are hugely important for understanding everything from how our brains develop to what we were eating
sure.
back then, to where people were and what kind of cultures they had. So I wanted to learn how to do this. So I went and trained with a couple of really legendary, at least one really legendary flint knapper, academic flint knapper. And then the guy that I met in India, who is becoming one of those as well, and spent just a week, you know, just knocking rocks together. And it's fun. It's interesting. It's cool because every one is this little geometric puzzle that you're trying to figure out how to hit this thing to get the outcome that you want,
right?
And not shatter it and destroy it.
And that type of that technology of flint knapping existed for millennia, right?
Absolutely. It goes back to before we were modern humans,
right?
The oldest stone tools, which they think they've identified in Kenya recently. I don't remember the date offhand, but we're talking, you know, millennia and millennia ago,
sure.
Where people are knocking rocks together to make something more useful out of it.
Right. So, I mean, the comparison, you know, as I think about it, is that, you know, the modern knife, I mean, alloyed steel, I mean, iron in itself doesn't actually make a particularly good sharp blade.
Right.
So, I mean, if you think about alloyed steel, you know, I mean, what are we really looking at in alloyed steel? Maybe 1,000 years, 2,000? I mean, really not.
Less, I think. Yeah.
I mean, very, you know, I think the bladesmithing in Japan goes back about 1,100 years. They've mm-hmm. traced it back. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty much it. So that's we've had knives as we understand them today for a much shorter amount of time.
Right. But that extremely sharp cutting implement, you know,
yep.
goes back much further, and is once you know how to do it, relatively easy to get a sharp cutting surface. But there are really complicated technologies. Like the one that I was trying to work on is this Neanderthal stone technology called Lavawa, which is named after a site in France where they found these tools. And it takes so much time to set up the core, which is what you're knocking the blades off of, in order to make one strike that would then pop off this particular kind of blade that's sharp all the way around and has kind of a haft on the end of it. And that's that takes a lot of planning and a lot of forethought, right, and a lot of understanding of geometry and how stone breaks and all these other things. So it's, even though these are, you know, quote unquote primitive technologies,
sure,
there's a lot of thought and a lot of technology and experience that goes into making them.
And it seems like there must, I mean, I have to imagine that in the realm of those Neanderthal who were making these things, I mean, that object was incredibly important. It allowed for so much more. I mean, it allowed you to cut things like meat, mm-hmm, and fish and, you know, plants. I mean, it allowed you to sort of change those in a way that you couldn't with your bare hands.
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of survival,
right,
at some point, because there's also the implements for personal defense and all these, you know, and hunting. Right. And so, yeah, extremely sophisticated tools matter life and death, I think, at that point, because that's all you have.
Right. In that, I mean, you know, to talk a little bit about that sort of, you know, that era sort of working off of the flint knapping and the tools that you were working on, do we know much about what those humans were in fact eating and cutting with those tools?
We know some, you know, and it's a question of what preserves at what kind of sites. So certainly bones can preserve, and we find butchery marks on those bones, and they find them in the context of fire and other things and the tools themselves that would suggest that, okay, these were things that people were eating. And that goes across the spectrum of what you can imagine sort of edible hunted animals would be. They, you know, they just recently found a butchered mammoth in Michigan. I mean, there's mammoths, you know, that they were probably maybe not hunting, or maybe they were hunting. We
right.
don't really know. They could have been scavenging them, but everything from that to small animals, to fish bones, I mean, whatever will preserve in that context. And then we know a little bit about the plants they were eating, from pollen grains, from these little bits of silica that are in plants called phytoliths that preserve pretty well, and residues on some of the stone tools, and then once pottery, you know, residues in pottery,
right,
that tell us what people were eating. What we do know from that is that there was a huge range of what people were eating, and, you know, food habits, as far as we know, back then were really heavily dependent on region and heavily dependent on seasonality and availability. So it's hard to tell what kind of proportions they were eating different things in. So there's a great body of knowledge and field of study sort of surrounding that. And there's some cool things that are starting to happen in science right now. In fact, I'm going to be working on a story very soon about looking at dental calculus, so plaque on your teeth, which actually preserves really well and has a tendency to preserve dietary proteins and other things. So there's ways to look at actual human remains to determine what people were eating as well.
Were they eating nuts? Were they eating meat? Were they eating fish?
And one of the things that they're able to look at this with this now is when and how did people start dairying, to start drinking milk and making milk-related products, and how that kind of spread, because that's a much more recent development.
Sure. Agriculturally related, most likely.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I wonder, you know, or at least some amount of domestication. I mean, I know that in some areas, you know, there are cultures that drink like mare's milk. So, you know, they ride the horse and then they milk it. And,
yeah,
you know, it's both transport and food source.
Yeah.
And what about eating tools? I mean, are there eating tools, and how far back do those go?
To my knowledge, you know, talk about ancient man.
Yeah. I'm thinking contemporary of these knives and things.
I actually don't know about eating tools. I suspect that they were probably using pieces of stone, but also they could have been, you know, if they're using wood or other kinds of organic materials, they don't preserve. So I think it's something that's pretty hard to find out.
And hands are pretty good for eating. I mean, there are still cultures now where there aren't eating tools. They don't use spoons, forks, you know, knives.
I grew up eating with my hands.
Sure.
Having a family that comes from India, from Western India, that was how we ate. So,
Hand is a good eating tool.
Yeah.
Not so much a butchering.
Yeah.
Not a very good butchering tool.
Right.
Is there any evidence, or do you know about whether or not those, you know, sort of early man, or potentially when sort of meal time became a thing, like culturally. Obviously, that's a really hard thing. I mean, how one would know what the societal sort of mores were of early man is sort of impossible, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't know that there's that much known about that, but it's pretty clear from inference and I think kind of common sense that a lot of these ancient cultures, particularly talking about early man, kind of revolved around food. It was just an essential part of both the work that they had to do, but also community building. And so I think there was a lot of communal sort of food consumption. And I think when you start to get into the history of human conflict, when you start to find evidence of that, that probably comes in terms of resource availability.
Sure.
And access to resources. So I think that huge portions of who we are today and what we know about ancient people revolves around food in some capacity.
Right.
But understanding that specific capacity is difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll keep talking about food and tools and early man.
Great.
October of 2013, Chef Frank Alania happily found himself in Marshall, Minnesota. Showing true Minnesota hospitality, Franco's hosts invited him to an afternoon of Midwest fun. They visited, among other things, a nearby bison farm and even a local shooting club. The only stipulation was that the men wanted a meal prepared by this master chef at the club's lodge. Franco worked his magic in the kitchen using locally available pumpkins, squashes, kale, bison steaks, and Minnesota wild rice. As a classically trained chef, Franco often made a risotto rice pancake. Franco substituted wild rice for the risotto and added some secret ingredients to his new recipe. Voila! Chef Franco's Minnesota wild rice griddle cakes were born. Now you too can enjoy these delicious griddle cakes and all the healthful benefits of wild rice. Purchase your very own box and help support a very time-honored American product, wild rice from Minnesota. For more information, visit frankolania.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. I've been speaking today with Samir Patel about archaeology, early man, flint knapping, some other things. So I'm going to turn the conversation now to avocado. I understand, Samir, that you don't actually really like avocado.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the only one. Although I like a good salty, spicy guacamole, but the slices of avocado
sure.
that end up on things, I feel like I'm the only person that doesn't like them.
I mean, I like it. I do find it interesting that it's become so ubiquitous. I mean,
yeah.
It is avocado toast and people talking about eating avocado. And I don't know if it's specifically related, but there's also, I feel like, given your sort of body of knowledge, I need to bring up the paleo diet.
And
I feel like avocado plays somewhat heavily in that. I don't know if that accounts for why avocados have gotten so popular.
I don't know.
But I wanted to talk for a minute about the sort of paleo diet.
Sure.
I meet a lot of people, obviously being in the grocery business, who come in and are very committed to the paleo diet. And,
yeah.
And I'm not against it as an idea. I think that, people have all kinds of food requirements they
yeah.
adhere to in one way or the other. And, whatever makes you happy is fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it is a little bit disingenuous, though, to say that you're living in 2016 in a way that our ancestors lived. And
yeah.
to make the claim that our ancestors, for some reason, were healthier than we are now because of the way that they were eating. I certainly less obese by and large, I would guess, but
yeah, they probably were, just because they didn't actually have all that much to eat.
Right.
But it's funny when, I was doing that butchery experiment at Brooklyn Kitchen, I made the joke that, you could start selling authentic stone cut meat to,
right.
to the paleo diet crowd. And I think in general, the paleo diet, operates on that sort of level when it comes to actual scientific basis for it. So, I mean, as a diet, I'm no nutritionist, but I've read a little bit about what they say about it. And, you know, certainly cutting out processed sugars and things like these, that's good,
right.
You know. But there's possibility for nutritional deficiencies in the diet. But the idea that it's all based on humans evolved to eat this way is, scientifically speaking, I mean, it's preposterous. As I mentioned before, we don't actually know the proportions in the diets of,
right.
of ancient people, of Paleolithic people. And some of the sort of basis is built on, okay, so modern hunter-gatherer societies, for example, who have very different diets.
Yeah.
There's no way to know what, and the idea that we had evolved to eat one diet, it doesn't make any sense, because if there's anything we know about the way that ancient people ate, it was that they had to be flexible, and they had
right.
to be opportunistic,
yep.
and they had to get calories wherever they could find them.
Yeah.
So the idea that you wouldn't eat grains or legumes, you know, we have evidence that certain Paleolithic societies did eat grains and legumes.
Sure.
So the idea that you would sort of arbitrarily kind of cut these things out doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, and you know, what you mentioned earlier, which to me sort of jumps out as one of the biggest or most clear sort of aspects of the way that early man must have eaten, is that it was incredibly local.
Yeah.
Even though these people were nomadic, it was local to wherever they happened to be at that given moment, right?
Yes,
so the idea that 365 days a year eating avocado makes you closer to our historic man is really silly, because only in the modern age can we in New York get avocado 365 days
right,
a year.
Right, right. Very regional, very seasonal, and very, like I said, opportunistic. So there are starvation foods, things that you turn to that you wouldn't unless, you know, your other resources aren't there. But the other thing that makes it sort of strange to say we evolved to do this is that we're, like, evolutionarily speaking, different than Paleolithic man was. And a perfect example is lactose tolerance. That arose 7,000 years ago, you know, among a subpopulation in Europe. So we are different, evolutionarily speaking. Our microbiota, you know, which
sure.
increasingly is shown to have some kind of effects on health and digestion, is very different
yep.
than what they were eating then.
Well, even regionally now.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
You know, people who are from different lineage of man, different places geographically in the globe, have evolved differently.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And food is different. Because if you look at, the thing that we know as an avocado now, I'll guarantee, didn't look like that, because we're constantly, you know, artificially selecting our food.
Sure.
So any kind of meat we're eating now is a product of some kind of domestication process.
Yep.
So it's different than wild foods. The perfect example is that broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, all come from the same species. They
right.
all come from a plant. It's not a mustard. It's called wild mustard. That maybe sort of Paleolithic man ate. But I mean, the idea that our foods somehow resemble what they were eating doesn't
sure.
make any sense either.
That's right.
that's even a bigger difference. Is
sure.
The foods aren't the same as what
right.
they were then, and they
yeah.
can't be.
And they weren't buying food either.
Right? No, no, of course not. Of course not. And they didn't have to think about matters of sustainability
right.
Because among the different diets out there, I think the paleo diet is a particularly unsustainable one.
Sure.
In terms of its caloric output per, you know, per sort of natural resources that
yep.
go into creating it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I felt like having you on the show, we had to sort of touch on
of
that
course,
a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah.
I noticed in reading a bunch of your articles that you've covered shipwrecks quite a bit. Is
yeah.
that a personal interest of yours, or is that just how things have sort of gone editorially with the magazine in the
past
10 years?
It's a personal interest of mine, because I went into the job having relatively recently become a certified scuba diver, and had right before the year before I started working there, taken a long, I got a fellowship when I finished journalism school. I took a long trip and did a lot of wreck diving even before I came to archaeology as a subject. And so that's something that instantly attracted me. For the adventure side of it, for the amount
yeah.
of stuff, it's just the underwater world is so stunning and amazing. And get to see all kinds of cool things when you go diving on shipwrecks. There's no doubt about it. So I've been on a couple of wrecks of pirate ships. Most recently, I was diving in Lake Huron, looking at sort of shipping in the Great Lakes. Mm. And so there's a lot of really, really cool stuff that comes out of the water. And it's something that I love doing, both for the thrill and for the, you know, the sense of discovery. Because when you're down there and you're looking around, it's, you know, it's hard not to be completely wide-eyed and befuddled by what you're seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never been diving on a wreck or anything, but as a kid, I was fascinated by that. I remember very clearly when the Titanic was found, mm-hmm. and that was such a huge deal because it was, you know, sort of the first modern super ship that wrecked, and you know, the stories behind it, obviously, and the way that the news traveled at the time. And, and so I remember that very clearly in the mid 80s when that was found,
yeah.
and what a big deal that was, and all the information about it. And, you know, and my father had a friend who was an antique dealer who used to show up at our house late at night with random things. my dad is a collector of things, and my dad didn't purchase this particular item, but I remember very clearly as a kid, right around when that happened, this guy named Ken Apollo showed up with a menu from the Titanic when it sank.
Yeah.
And I held it in my hands as a kid.
Oh, that's really cool.
And it was this incredible connection to sort of what was happening and all this stuff that I knew, like that's one tiny object from this giant ship, the rest of which is at the bottom of the ocean. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because the Titanic, a lot of people don't necessarily, because it's been, you know, James Cameron and all this, you know, stuff around it. It actually, like, we can consider, and we had a piece on this a while ago written by a very well-known maritime archaeologist about how the Titanic is now, we can consider it an archaeological site because despite its depth, technology has made it possible to do sort of high resolution scans of the wreck and to start to look at items and things to learn more about how it went down, you know, various things. So it's, you can now see that and some deep water, really deep water wreck sites as true archaeological sites, despite their obvious difficulty of accessing them, which is really cool. Some really cool technology. It's constantly kind of evolving in terms of what we're able to do with deep, deep sites.
Well, deep cold water is a great preserver, right? So, I mean, you know, I know that there's, you know, there have been ancient bottles of beer, wine, things like that found, you know, there was some beer, I believe, that came out of the bottom of the Black Sea.
Yeah.
That, you know, it was 200 something years old and was perfectly preserved. I mean, it was encrusted with all kinds of sea life, but it was a sealed bottle.
Right, right. They've done, I think, tastings of some of these things that have been, because they've found liquor, beer, champagne, and in some cases, it's been opened and tasted, and sometimes it's pretty well skunked.
Yeah.
And sometimes it retains some of its flavor over time. But yeah, the sea can be definitely a good preservative for some of that stuff if the seals remain intact. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, I would imagine of the rest of, you know, of the ships themselves, of the wood, of the tools, of the other items. And, you know, I have to, you know, also remembering from my childhood of, like, mm-hmm. going to the Met and visiting the Temple of Dendor and all these things.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking about how, like, well, this was in Egypt, right? And then they brought it to New York City,
sure,
and how weird that is, and reading about all of the grave robbing and things like that. So, you know, shipwrecks, it's, I mean, the access you talk about is very difficult, right? And that's what, I guess that's always the draw of finding the pirate ship, right? That you're going to find the lost treasure.
Yeah.
But also from an archaeological standpoint, I have to imagine the idea that it's never been touched.
Yeah, it's very cool. And there's there is a very contentious sort of world surrounding underwater archaeology with respect to salvage companies and the law of the sea and whether this is an archaeological site and how you treat an archaeological site. And there are private companies that go out and essentially look for treasure, and different countries will make claims on it depending on whose stuff it was and whether it was flotsam or jetsam that came out of the wreck. And so it's that is very fraught.
Sure, because the law and the sea and the land are very different. Whereas I just read an article about London and how they're finding all kinds of Roman ruins and things all the time when they're building these new buildings in London. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know to a lesser extent that happens here, you know, in New York. I mean, New York has been inhabited for a long time. And whenever they build a new building downtown, they find things. But, you know, but that's very clear. It's on land. right? Mm-hmm. And so there's very clear laws that relate to whose it is and what you have to do.
In different countries, yeah. Based on, so different countries have different laws, sure, about cultural patrimony. If you find ancient stuff in Italy, it's the property of the government, whereas here it's the property of the landowner. Hmm. So there are very different laws depending on the country that govern sort of cultural remains.
And there was an article that I saw that you guys did, I think back in 2014, about some castaways on a tiny little island,
yeah,
in the Indian Ocean that I thought was fascinating. I mean, that there was a group of slaves, right, who were headed for Mauritius.
Yes. So this was, I wrote this story. I'm trying to remember the time frame because I go through so much. I think it was late 18th century. And it was a group of people that had been enslaved on Madagascar by these sort of traders, and they got shipwrecked on this island, this little speck.
Right. I mean,
Tromelin Island, yeah, in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And the sort of white traders had sort of built a kind of rescue ship, and they left. And for, was it 8 years?
I think it was more. I think it was like 12 or 15 years. This small community kind of lived there, as I remember. The thing that I found most interesting was the article talks about some of the cooking and eating tools. I mean, you know, we're at a point, I mean, we're all the way to the 18th century, so there are bowls and things like that. Yeah. But that there was a photograph with the article of a copper bowl that looked like it had been repaired like 85 times.
Yeah.
Where these people, you know, there were no resources. They're on a blank rock that just had like bushes.
All they had was the stuff they got from the wreck.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, they had to make do with that, and there were no more resources, and there was nobody to trade with. And so that, to me, was sort of very interesting that this, you know, community had managed to exist.
Well, and barely survived.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest, there was like 8 or 9 that were,
right,
left.
Sure.
By the time they did finally get rescued.
Yeah.
It was the thing that stood out to me among that was the homes that they had to build little homes for shelter. And where they had come from in Madagascar, homes were built out of organic materials, so wood and thatch and mud and whatever. And the only thing that was put in kind of a stone box was the dead were buried in these kind of the burial cists. But in order to survive on this island, all they had was stone. So they essentially had to build themselves
coffins,
graves to live,
wow,
in. And so that's, I mean, survival has a way of breaking down cultural taboos. And so I thought that was a pretty remarkable story. And there were a couple of archaeologists from Madagascar involved who were able to add some of that kind of cultural perspective to what the researchers who were French were finding there.
Hmm. If you were marooned on an island, what food would you want to have with you if you could only have one?
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say tacos because
it's not cheating. It's not just an answer.
Tacos because that is obviously a catch-all for a wide range of fillings.
Sure.
Yeah, I would.
And doesn't require tools to eat.
Of course, so. Doesn't require tools to eat. Yeah, and it's spicy and delicious. So. Yeah, I would pick tacos.
Nice. Well, we're pretty much at the end of the show. Is there any? Do you have any articles you're working on that people should look at? I definitely encourage all of you out there listening to check out archaeology.org, and it is also a print magazine.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
You can subscribe to the print magazine. But do you have any articles coming up that you're working on that you want to mention?
You know, we're constantly sort of putting together lots and lots of material. I am excited about this story that I'm going to go report about. I mentioned the dental plaque.
Yeah.
And there's a researcher who's doing some really amazing things in terms of reconstructing not just dietary proteins, but bacteria. So looking at actually both pathogens, disease-causing bacteria, and the ancient sort of microbiome, the oral microbiome. Yeah. So I think that's going to be a really cool kind of sciencey sort of piece. But yeah, there's always something different in our pages. So I'm working on a piece now about a Civil War era a shipwreck in Savannah Harbor. So I mean, the stuff comes from all over.
Right.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining me today on Feast Your Ears, and thanks everybody who was listening to this show. Big thank you to Kristen Baylor, who's my producer here, and to Liz Smith, who engineers this show every Wednesday. And please take a moment to like the show on Facebook and iTunes. See you next week.
Thank you.
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.